When it was released back way back in 1993, the album Exile in Guyville by Liz Phair was almost immediately hailed as a classic. It landed at the top of the Village Voice's influential Paz and Jop poll and made Phair the darling of the indie set. Now she's reissuing that classic album to mark the 15th anniversary since its inception. She made a new documentary to include with the album. Let's listen to a clip where she revisits characters from that chapter of her life about what Exile in Guyville was all about.
With Guyville, there were angles galore. And one of the great angles was, it's a song-by-song reply to Exile on Main Street. Is that true?
I promise. I can go through it with you and explain. Okay. Like, it wouldn't make sense to anyone else. It really wouldn't.
I mean, when you came up with the idea, that was great.
But, you know, but when people were saying, like, you know, she spent months, like, assembling the song-for-song response to the Rolling Stones.
I did.
Oh, come on.
John, I did. Cross my heart, hope to die. Why would I lie now?
Even if it wasn't true, just to merely
say
put
that.
Those words on paper meant that they would be repeated over and over and over again until this very day.
Apart from its cultural allusions, the record got a lot of attention for its sexual content and profanity. And as we found out when she came by the BPP studios to talk about revisiting the record, she's lost none of her charm or her affinity for four-letter words. Walk us back in time for people who didn't buy the album in 1993, who weren't around in Chicago at that time. Describe what Guyville is.
Guyville, the concept, what Guyville itself was.
Yeah.
Guyville was the sort of, I think it was coined, the phrase was coined by Blackie Onassis from the band Urge Overkill to describe the kind of guys, as he would put it.
Guys.
In Chicago. Guys. In Chicago at the time, like, I could give you just a visual picture. They wore sort of pegged jeans, and they often had their wallet attached to their jeans by a chain. And they tended to wear black leather jackets that fit tightly, motorcycle jackets that they zipped all the way up. But anyway, they felt to me like a mafia of music lovers who were supposedly representing sort of alternative, but at the same time, I found them to be sort of oppressive. Like, you couldn't like certain bands if they were too pop. And if you didn't know, you know, which band had split up to reform the band that you were discussing, like, then you didn't have an opinion. You couldn't even, you know, throw out an opinion because you just didn't have the background.
Sorry, I like their music. I didn't know the whole tree and history.
Green River, Mud
guys.
Honey,
oh,
I don't, you know, whatever.
I don't know. The song sounded good to me. My
so
mistake.
Guyville was what I was sort of dating and laboring under, both in that little small artsy village of Wicker Park in Chicago. And what, rebelling against with the record.
What had to happen to you to get to the point where you said, you know what, I'm making this the thesis of my debut?
The big you, the big, like, fingers up in the air that Guyville was, like, it goes way beyond Wicker Park. It goes back in time to high school. That same sense of being a girl and not being listened to and not being considered serious about music opinions if you didn't do your scholarly research on, like, if you hadn't been buying vinyl since seventh grade, then you weren't really in the game.
In the club, yeah.
And I was like a diamond of pressurized anger at that point, you know, like, by the time I made Guyville, I was pissed, you know, I'd been the girlfriend of the guy in the band plenty of times. I'm asking you, Mary, please, temper my hatred with peace, weave my disgust into fame.
Can you talk a little bit about how that need to kind of bust through that click jibed with what you had defined as another counter thesis, which was the whole relationship of that album with the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street? How did that album inspire you?
You know, I can sum it up for you. I think I'd become something of a stalker. And I had this huge crush on this guy in the scene. And he and I had like a couple interactions, but nothing really serious. And I invented in my crazy ass mind the idea of like on the record Exile on Main Street, Mick's character mm-hmm. was this guy. And so whenever I listened to Exile on Main Street, I felt like I was listening to what
This guy. Who shall remain nameless.
Except if you buy the DVD. And then, like what he was saying, like it was totally a picture of his life. It was a perfect portrait of this guy's life.
So you superimpose the stones on your kind of on your life.
On my crush, and then I sort of wrote back to him, like either I was like, because you think about the first song on Exile on Main Street, he's coming home from this one night stand, he runs into some girl he knows who's sort of like, where have you been? And he's like, look, man, I just can't deal with you right now, and walks off. So I put myself in the shoes of that girl he meets on the street, and that's how I write 6-1. Listen to the two songs, and I put dynamic in there. So if that was an upbeat song, I made it an upbeat rocker, and maybe I'd look where the solo was, and I'd do it like that. But it was like my answer to this guy vis-a-vis the Stones.
Was he like Mick Jagger in any way?
Yeah.
Did he look like him?
He didn't look like him, but he sure as hell acted like him. Yes, 100%.
In that record, there's this whole range of emotions and characteristics, personal traits. It's ambition, a young woman's really kind of raw ambition. It's her disappointment. It's her lust. It's her joy.
You don't forget sadness, because when I go back and listen to that record, there's some really moving, telling songs. Like Canary is a really good one.
I jump when you circle the cherry. I sing like a good canary. I come when called. I come, that's all. Send it up on fire, Dave, before dawn.
As a female, I don't think you're supposed to say the kind of things I wanted to say. I don't, or at least I had gotten myself into a position where I didn't feel comfortable saying to people's faces a lot of stuff I said on that record.
Trying to figure out how to make this statement, how to break through this world, did you sit down and make a conscious decision that it had to be not just about gender, but it had to really be about sex, explicit talk about sex?
I think I felt like I had been listening for 10 years to records where guys talked explicitly about sex. And then all the women that came out with music, barring a few like Patti Smith and Chrissy Hynde and other people, women were sort of shunted to the area of emotion. But I've always been pissed off, frankly, that whole myth that women aren't interested in sex. If you had 30,000 years of really bad consequences for being interested in sex, you might hide it too. Like you might, you know, so women sort of sing like, I was thinking of you, you know, and I wanted to be like, I want to f*** you, I want to f*** hard, I want to f*** bad, like now, you know what I mean? Like I wanted to take that back and say, I can do it too.
There is also, though, a recognition in that album that sex is a tool, and you had figured out that, oh, I don't have to be this, I don't have to be this, I can use it when I want to my advantage. And is that...
And detriment.
How so?
Well, I'll just get really honest with you right now, but I was pretty good in bed at that point from the point of view of what the guys wanted, mm-hmm. but pretty bad in bed in terms of what my own enjoyment. And yes, that made me angry. But it was my own fault in some sense. You know, it was culturally, there's the expectation that you have to kind of fulfill this thing and guys will like you and then it's great. But, you know, my music mellowed out a lot when I started to understand my own body and how to enjoy myself. And, you know, I think that using sex as a tool was very much on my mind at that point, because I felt like that's what I was doing. I didn't know why I was doing that. I knew that it conferred benefits, but it also, it hurt me. I was like hurting myself by doing that.
We are talking to Liz Phair. We're talking about the re-release of her 1993 album, Exile in Guyville. When you listen to this now, what do you hear?
I hear how, I gotta say it, I kind of hear how unhappy I was. Like, I hear, it makes my heart go out to the person that I was in a lot of ways. And as much as I'm taking a tough stance and acting tough, it's so clear to me now, in retrospect, how unsure I was and how vulnerable I really was. And as tough as I come across trying to be on the record, that's really the beauty of Guyville, is that it's really such a portrait of a vulnerable young woman trying to establish some kind of power for herself.
Did you find that exhausting?
Yeah, I did. You know, I really did. I sure as hell don't miss it. You know what I mean? Like, and, you know, it was exhausting, and All I could do really was kind of take that hard stand, kind of lash out sometimes. And also, I think I'm honest on Guyville. I think there are songs that show the devastating part of it. Like, F***ing Run is a great example of that. Like, having a one-night stand and walking away and really wishing it had been something entirely different. But you're to blame as much as the guy.
I woke up alone. I didn't know where I was at first, just
this album came out, all of a sudden it jettisoned you into a totally different stratosphere. I imagine it would be a little bit freaky to think, wow, I really hit it big. Like, this was a success. I hit one out of the park. How in the world do I match other people's expectations for what I'm supposed to be?
I just wanted to make it through the day. I wanted to make it through the photo shoot or whatever performance I had to do. I took a lot of support from my friends. They'd drive me to the show, and I'd be like, I don't want to do this. You know, I'd freak out 2 weeks before I had to play. I'd wake up in the middle of the night with sweats. And a lot of those performances really were bad. But I think people were there also to see the vulnerability. And I covered that up in the last couple of years. I became good at what I did. And I think I missed the boat on knowing that part of what they came to see was to see that vulnerability. Now I'm starting to try to open that up again so that I can put that forth.
Well, the album, in case you haven't figured it out yet, it's called Exile in Guyville. It was made in 1993. It's been 15 years. It's being re-released. Liz Phair, we're so happy you came by. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Fun conversation, and good luck with everything this year. Big
thank you.
No secret, we enjoyed our conversation with Liz Phair. It took many twists and turns. She divulged all kinds of secrets, well, maybe not secrets, but all kinds of stuff I didn't know about her.
For 20 minutes, we talked about the Democratic race. When we taped it, there was an actual race.
There was a race, and she's a vocal supporter of Senator Hillary Clinton. She's not afraid to say it.
So I guess that and Guyville worked out in different ways for her.
In different ways. Yeah. She also talked about her fear of the Star-Spangled Banner a little
bit. Yeah, she was maybe overwhelmed by that at a White Sox game, and she has a new album coming out that she worked on. That was one of my That and the Army Dentist were my two all-time favorite interviews in the history of the BPP, in my history.
We enjoyed that one. Yeah. So, yeah,
well, you know what? I'm going to put the Army Dentist second.
I know. We had a good time with her.
We loosened them up after a while.
Look for her new album. Liz Phair's new album will be coming out later this year. In the meantime, Exile in Guyville being re-released 15 years after its inception. That's it for this hour of the BPP. We're online all the time. This is Rachel Martin.
I'm Mike Pesca.